It is June 9th, 1727. The sailing vessel Zeevolk of the Dutch East India Company, or VOC, has been at sea since November of 1726. After a stop at the Cape of Good Hope in southern Africa to resupply, the ship is now en route to the Dutch settlement of Batavia on the island of Java. Under the orders of Captain Jan Steins, the ship's course has been altered to east-northeast to make an unscheduled stop at Eendracksland, the still little-known coast of Western Australia. It's 7:30, just after dusk, and steersman Joris Forksen has the watch. Exiting his cabin, Captain Steins and undermerchant Jan Nebbens join Forksen on the quarterdeck to get a view of their progress. Glimpsing into the distance, Steins asks, "Who has the watch? What is that which can be seen ahead?" Before Forksen could answer, Steins shouts, "My God, it is breakers! Lay your helm to starboard!" The ship lurches, and Steins calls for his first and second mates from the chart room. But before anything could be done, the Zeevolk crashes into the coral reef before her with a horrifying jolt, spinning her bow into the wind. Second mate Adrian van der Graaf diligently keeps a journal throughout the journey. He writes, "I made my way to the steerage and found there to be 8 feet of water in the ship, whereupon our mainmast fell overboard. We then decided to cut away our fore and mizzenmasts and found our ship to be lying in 10 to 11 feet of water, so that we prayed the Almighty for a propitious outcome. While terrible waves washed over us constantly, we attempted to cut away the top hamper. A seaman named Jurien Ralofsen was washed overboard together with the foremast and bowsprit, so that we looked at one another sorrowfully and prayed for surcease from the terrible punishment which the Almighty was sending us. We asked the lookout, who had been sitting on the foreyard, whose name was Peter de Klerk van Appel, whether he had seen the surf. He confessed at once that he had seen it for at least 30 minutes, but had imagined that it was caused by the sky or the moon." Much of what we know of the demise of the Zeevolk and the fate of its survivors comes from the journal of understeersman Adrian van der Graaf, whose daily journal provides vivid insights of the actions taken both before and after the wreck. Isolated on a tiny speck of land, the sailors and soldiers of the Zeevolk would have to rely on their own ingenuity in the face of harsh conditions in order to survive. The extraordinary story of the Zeevolk, today on Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Hello and welcome to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs, Tales of Mishaps, Misfortune, and Misadventure. Today we'll be returning to the waters of Western Australia, and I'm excited to have back on the show, resident expert of Western Australian history, Dr. Howard Gray. Dr. Gray, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Gritch. It's good to be with you again and to share some WA stories.
Listeners may recall hearing you on the episodes about the Batavia, but let's start with a little about you and your work and your experiences.
Yeah, I live on the west coast of Australia, a little town called Geraldton, and along the west coast here, we've got a fantastic maritime history. Right from the indigenous Aboriginal people who were there fishing and activities along the shoreline, a really important part of their culture and survival. And of course, then in the early 1600s, we had the Dutch coming by on their way to the Spice Islands. So one of the consequences of that, apart from discovery of for the Europeans of the West Coast, was that we actually had four really big shipwrecks here too. The Batavia we spoke about last time, the Gilt Dragon down near Launceston, a little bit closer down towards Perth. Then in 1656, 1712, we had the Zoutdorp up on the cliffs, just a little bit further up from where we are. And then 1727, we had the wreck of the Zeevolk out on the Abrolhos Islands offshore from here. So we've got, you know, these four big Dutch shipwrecks. And, of course, you've got a big history that follows on from the British coming here and all of the settlement and all of the maritime enterprises and the important part shipping played up and down the coast here, whalers, all sorts of things going on here, right through to the present time. Yeah, so really, really rich maritime history. It's been good to be a part of that. You know, I do some research, do a fair bit of writing, do some radio programs about it, do a lot of guiding and, you know, lecturing and so on around these local stories. And, yeah, just to try and make sure that all these things are kept alive and people appreciate what we've got.
The last time you were here with me, we talked about the Batavia, which was a three-part series, and that occurred in 1629 off the coast of Western Australia. That is still probably my favorite shipwreck story of all time, just for the sheer mayhem and chaos that occurred in the aftermath of the wreck. So if anyone hasn't listened to those episodes with Dr. Gray as my guest, please go back and listen when you get a chance. It's quite a story. But today, we're discussing another ship of the VOC, or the Dutch East India Company, the Zeevik, which occurred in 1727, almost 100 years after the Batavia. So, for those who may not be familiar, could you tell us what the Dutch East India Company was?
Yeah, so the Dutch East India Company was basically a consortium, if you like, of all of the various spice trading companies in the Netherlands that in the late 1500s, early 1600s, they decided that instead of competing with each other for the spice trade in the East Indies, they would actually pool their resources, and they formed the VOC. And thereafter, they sent out flotillas of company ships, fleets of company ships, pretty much every year, right through for a couple of hundred years to the East Indies, Indonesia, the Spice Islands there, up into Asia, across to India, all sorts of enterprises they got going. But the primary focus for them was, in fact, what became known as the Dutch East Indies, because of the VOC trading that happened through there and pretty much continued with the Dutch. The VOC went broke in the late 1700s, but the Dutch government took over, and right through until the end of the Second World War was still under control of the Dutch.
And their exploration and their trade routes really did a lot to map the coast of Western Australia at that time, which at the beginning of the VOC was largely unknown. And that's why there's so many Dutch shipwrecks on the western coast.
Yeah, exactly. They figured that like the Portuguese have been going in along those to the East Indies since the early 1500s, and the Dutch, when they got into it in the early 1600s, figured out that a safer and much, much quicker way to get to the East Indies, instead of going up around Madagascar and all against the contrary winds up along the east coast of Africa, they could zip across the southern waters in the Roaring Forties from Cape Town across to the east, you know, do 1,000 Dutch miles or so, then pick up the trade winds that carried them straight up to Sunda Strait, the gateway into Indonesia. And they actually cut 6 months off the voyage. But of course, the problem they had there was had the latitude pretty well nailed. It was quite difficult for them to precisely know where they were by longitude. And inevitably, some of them strayed too far to the east. Dirk Hartog, 1616, a couple after in the years nearby to there. Frederick de Houtman came into the near the southwest corner, Cape Leeuwen, it's called today, and came up the coast, discovered the Houtman Abrolhos Islands. And so very quickly, the west coast and then the Great Australian Bight was put on the map, 1627. And then the Dutch explored all around the northwest coast. Tasman, 1642, went along the south coast and around Tasmania, New Zealand. And so we pretty much had all of the coast of Australia, except for that east coast, on the charts by the mid-1640s. So the Dutch were critical in that. They didn't find anything of interest for themselves there in terms of trading or resources, so they pretty much just said, give it a miss. It's too dangerous, particularly after the shipwrecks of the Batavia and so on. In fact, there was an earlier English ship, the Trial, wrecked up on the coast as well, 1622. So they more or less said, you know, don't head too far east. Make sure you head to the north pretty early on so you don't run the risk of running into the west coast. And the Dutch could well have claimed, you know, as Europeans were doing in those days, Australia as their territory, but they gave it a miss, and it wasn't until the The French actually made a claim in the late 1700s, but that never was followed up. And then the English came, of course, through in the 1800s.
The Zeevolk set out from Vlissingen in the Netherlands on the 7th of November, 1726, and it carried 208 seamen and soldiers, and it was headed to the capital of the Dutch East Indies, the city of Batavia, which is now modern-day Jakarta in Indonesia. What exactly would you find on a Dutch East Indiaman at that time, traveling between the Netherlands and the Dutch East Indies?
Well, obviously you needed a pretty big crew on board to sail the ship, and you also need to be prepared for the fact that, you know, a lot of the crew died along the way, so you probably almost needed a third or a double, you know, half as many again as you, just to counter the deaths along the way. So you need all the resources for that, all the resources you'd need for sailing a ship for perhaps 9 months, you know, spare sails, spare timbers, spare rigging, and all the food and water and resources. And then, of course, you're actually going to trade. So you'd be taking trade goods, things that you thought might sell in the East Indies. And that included things like silverware and such like. But also the main thing, really important part of that, was silver. And that in various forms of different coins, Spanish pieces of eight and such like, many different forms of coinage, but all silver that was used once they got to the East Indies to trade for the spices they needed there. So aboard, the Zeevolk had 10 chests of silver, probably around about, I don't know, Australian dollars, I reckon maybe 10 million Australian dollars at the moment it would be worth, so maybe 5 million US dollars. You know, so it was a lot of money on board to trade with. So as well as crew, they usually carried contingents of soldiers, which the Dutch really needed a good military around them, because you know they were not welcomed participants in most of India, you know, welcome in Indonesia, and so wherever they went, they needed to take an armed party with them and pretty much reside in fortresses to. Even at that stage, you know, because it was very, very dangerous for them. So they had the military on board. And of course, there was always, as well as that, the risk that maybe the opportunity to raid another ship or to defend yourself. So there was a lot of cannons on board as well. So a lot of armory on board, aboard the ship as well. So when you put it all together, it was pretty well loaded up. It would have been pretty chock-a-block to start with. And gradually things would have whittled down as they got along the way. So by the time the Zeevolk wrecked, of course, a lot of supplies would have disappeared, but they also had on board a lot of cheeses and wines and all sorts of things that they were taking out for the Dutch settlers. So they were also all on board the ship as well, and that might have been what actually managed to save these guys in their particular situation.
Now, the captain of the Zeevolk was a man named Jan Steins, and he was a last-minute replacement for another captain who was ill at the time. And it turned out that this was his first and ultimately last command, unfortunately for him. But you mentioned earlier the route across the southern Indian Ocean, and as you know, that's called the Brouwer Route. Why was that so important to the Dutch at that time?
Well, it was important because it, a number of things. Number one, it made the voyage so much shorter in terms of time, and therefore death, you know, even on the Zeevolk, which incidentally only had men on board. Normally these ships carried families and things and women as well, but this ship only had men on board. But by the time they got to Table Bay, 28 had died. So there was a pretty severe outbreak, and they took another lot of people ashore. Maybe 40 or 50 more went ashore at Cape Town to recuperate. So they had to replace those. So they lost a lot of crews. That was a pretty disastrous voyage in that regard, but the Brouwer route was supposed to save them time and thus save money, save lives, and it also avoided the Portuguese, who were still busily running up and down the west coast of Africa and were putting, you know, a lot of hostilities there, getting across the south of Sumatra or through the Malacca Straits and so on was also pretty dangerous. So by coming across the Brouwer route and up the west coast, they sailed straight in up through the Sunda Strait, around the corner of Java, and there was their settlement they'd set up in the 1619 or so, Batavia, and it was a really well fortified city, and so everybody else kept well away.
And you mentioned earlier the trouble they had at that time determining their longitude. Of course, that's very important because they have to know when to turn north. And if you don't turn north at the right time, you're in big trouble. And I came across a really interesting little bit about the captain on the route across the Indian Ocean on the 27th of April, and this is still 1727. He ordered a turn to the east-northeast toward the land of Eendracht, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that was Western Australia. Now, as you know, it was forbidden for VOC ships to make any unscheduled stops. So what possibly could he have wanted to do? What was there? Was there a significant port or a trading post of any kind in Western Australia at that time? Why would he have done that?
This remains a mystery, you know, why he would have firstly disobeyed the fairly strict sailing instructions that they were given by the VOC, which, you know, basically forbid them from going near the West Australian coast. You know, make your turn early, don't venture into near the coast. But he decided apparently that he wanted to have a look at this coastline for himself, and overruled the first mate and others who weren't too keen on the idea, and managed to get it written into the documents that, you know, they had agreed to divert to the northeast and to encounter the east or the west coast of this Southland, or Eendracht Land, as it was named after Dirk Hartog's ship, or the Southland, Zoutland, as it was known as well. And it's a mystery as to why he did that. And it's also interesting that what charts he might have had, because the earlier charts all showed the Abrolhos fairly clearly, but some of the ones that came along in the late 1600s, the ships had actually sailed up along the coast, and actually not all the charts actually showed the Abrolhos very clearly. You know, that he might have had a chart in front of him that maybe didn't even have the islands marked on them. So it's always something I'm trying to, you know, there's no answer to that. We don't exactly know the answer to that. But the charts that were made by the ships that just went along the coast, recorded the coast, and the islands were there very, very vaguely marked on charts, sometimes really misplaced and such like. So he might have had a bit of an excuse there, but he certainly had no authority to be heading towards the west coast of Australia just to check it out and have a look. He was very much against orders. And, of course, that came to bite him later.
I was really curious about that because the Haltmann Abrolhos were very slightly charted at the time of the Batavia. I figured 100 years later they would be well known, especially considering the disaster of the Batavia and other ships that had wrecked before this. So it baffles me of why and how that could have happened, but maybe they were forgotten about.
Well, you have a look at the charts, and often you see just a string of little islands along there, which sort of seems to just indicate what maybe Haltmann looked. But as I said, a lot of the other Dutch ships that did come along and chart the coast, the Vlemming and so on, in the 1690s, they actually followed right along the coast rather than didn't actually see the islands themselves. The islands are 60 kilometres, 30 nautical miles offshore. Now, they extend over 100 kilometres, but if you're looking the other way, you know, you're sort of sailing much, you know, sort of a third of the way across, you probably, you know, you wouldn't actually see them. So some of the charts don't actually show them at that time. So that's one of the mysteries there as well. But it was interesting that, as it turns out, the Zavec actually guys put the Abrolhos on the charts more accurately. The Abrolhos chain consists of three groups of islands, but they only put one group of islands on the charts. There are two more big groups to the north of there, and they didn't appear on the charts. Like a guy called Philip Parker King, 1822, he was given the job of charting the coast. He just picked up the 1727 chart, and it wasn't until 1840 that they realised that the Abrolhos consisted of three groups of islands. So, you know, it was as late as that that they actually got properly put on the charts.
And many of the islands of the Haltmann Abrolhos are just, a meter, 2 meters above sea level, is that right?
Exactly. You know, so unless you're close by, you know, during the day, you know, with perhaps a decent swell throwing up some waves and whatever, yeah, unless you're really, really close, you're not even aware they are there. The French were others that came by a bit early 1800s, and they, you know, they obviously came along the coast as well because they didn't appear on their charts. So, it doesn't stand up much at all. The highest point's only 15 metres in one or two little islands, yeah.
Hey everyone, Rich here. As much as I love telling you about maritime history, I also listen to a lot of podcasts, and I want to tell you about one that I personally love, American Elections Wicked Game. There have been some wild elections in American history that broke all the rules of civility. There have been elections decided behind closed doors, elections that resulted in murder. And when you learn all this and that we endured vicious, vile political contests over and over, you might come away feeling a little better about what's to come in 2024. From the host of American History Tellers, American Elections Wicked Game explores the entire history of presidential elections, from the unanimous and inevitable election of George Washington in 1789 to Donald Trump's surprise electoral victory in 2016 and his contested defeat in 2020. Follow American Elections Wicked Game wherever you're listening now, or to get early ad-free access to the entire series, bingeable now, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com. So the 9th of June, 1727, the Zavik is sailing along, and as it approaches the Haltmann Abrolhos, what happens? Why do they slam into the reef?
Well, it's that same story we heard with the Batavia, the lookout up the mast. A guy called Jan Fuchsen, you know, was looking ahead, and he'd apparently seen some white water for half an hour or so, and it wasn't until the skipper came on board at dusk and looked ahead, and he said, what's that ahead of us? And then before anyone could reply, realized it was surf, you know, turn the rudder, you know, see if we can get out of here. But once again, the fact that coming in behind the swell onto a reef, white water there simply looked like it might have been moonlight on the water, you know, early in the evening, or just the light effects on the water. So it appeared to be nothing unusual to Fawkes. And in fact, he'd watched it for a little while beforehand.
That is strikingly similar to what happened to the Batavia, almost exactly. They thought it was the moonlight, everything's fine, and then all of a sudden their ship is in big trouble. After the ship slams into what was Half Moon Reef, what was the condition of the ship? How badly damaged was it?
They wrecked it about 7:30 in winter, you know, so it was after sundown. So the ship actually swung around a little bit into the waves, so that unlike the Batavia, which had sort of run straight up with the waves crashing on the stern, it actually swung around a bit, so the bow was facing at least somewhat into the swell coming in, which is probably what saved it, you know, to some extent, in that it was able to ride the swell coming in, but even so, being driven back onto the reef and crunching up and down and soon coming to rest there. It's a very exposed bit of reef. It is the first bit of Australia that cops all of the big swells that come in from the Southern Ocean, you know, from Antarctica. These, you know, there can be 4, 5, 6, 9 meter swells pound on that reef continuously. It's barely ever, hardly find a day in the year when there's not some swell of some sort pounding onto that reef edge there. So the time they were there, it appears that they were copping a fair bit of swell, and of course, you know, what do you do? Except just try and hang on to begin with.
That sounds pretty terrifying, to be sure. And about half of those on board died in the wreck or in its immediate aftermath. And as per usual, a few of them stayed behind on the wreck and helped themselves to the liquor cabinet. But 96 of the survivors made it to a nearby island.
Yeah, there wasn't the deaths. One of the crew got washed over. Another fell in the water when they were trying to launch a boat. A couple of others died when they were trying to get across the reef and so on. So there were actually a lot of deaths and drownings there. And, of course, by this stage, it was probably about 130 or so, I think, actually meant it was still on the boat and still okay. But, of course, they had to get across. The reef is sort of, there's an outer reef and then there's a shallows and then it gets into a little bit of deeper water. So the boats on the ship weren't able to be floated across the shallows. So the and of course there's the swell pounding across here. Imagine waves surging across here, getting the boat off, trying to get people in that, trying to get across. And of course you want to come back to pick up more people or whatever. It was really, really hard. So they were able to set up some of the foremast washed overboard with sails and other stuff, and that washed up onto the reef and made a little bit of a staging station a few hundred meters inshore. So they managed to, they decided they'd get across to there and sort of use that as a base because the nearest island's another couple of kilometers away from there. They could see the islands off in the distance. So they managed to eventually get a boat across to what they called the Vleet, which was this pile of stuff that had washed up on the reef, and progressively get the crew across. And it took them about a month to do this, to progressively get nearly everybody across to the little island, which we know today as Gun Island. Some of the crew didn't want to leave, wanted to stay on the ship, thought there was a bit of more food and resources there than on the island. Others, there was a bit of a case to begin with where people got stuck into the grog and so on, and they quickly brought that under control, unlike with the Batavia setup. So they basically swore an oath to each other that they would, you know, not misbehave. And eventually they did get the majority of them across to this little island, today we know as Gun Island, which is only a few hundred meters, you know, maybe 200 meters long, 100, 150 meters wide. It's a really small little flat-topped island, a couple of meters out of the water, covered with a bit of low scrub, bit of blown sand and built up bird dropping guano, as we call it, on top of it. So it was not a nice forested tropical island by any means at all.
And were they able to find any food or did they have fresh water on Gun Island?
No, one of the things that they were able to survive for longer was that they actually were able to salvage water and wine and cheeses and bread and other victuals from the wreck. Even though the wreck had, the ship had hulled, you know, the hull had hulled and the water had filled most half it and a lot of stuff was underwater and so on, a lot of it damaged, they were able, basically by chucking barrels of stuff off the side and letting it wash ashore and then salvage them on the reef edge, get some supplies from there. But the other thing around the islands is there's a lot of sea lions. There's the Australian sea lion, which are, you know, pretty big beasts. They can grow to a couple of metres and a couple of 100 to 200 kilos, and they managed over the course of the next couple of months to kill over 200 of them. So around the islands, they'd go across these little islands nearby and find sea lions, and further afield there was another Long Island. They found more over there, and so they pretty much would have wiped out the population of sea lions during the time they were there. So it was that kept them going. Winter time, of course, June and in Australia, so that's when the winter rains come through. They were able to capture some rains, but there was periods when they were desperately short of water. They found a well on one island, which they thought had already been opened up by maybe other shipwreck survivors, but you know, they were uncertain about a few other clues around that idea as well. But they were able to find water there, quite a reasonable supply, kept them going. You've got to remember, we've got over 100 guys here. You've got to feed and water 100 men. It takes a fair bit of food to do that every day, you know. And I don't think they were, you know, sort of, you don't hear them talk much about rationing stuff. They seem to, you know, let's open another cask of wine. You know, the men have demanded another one. So they, you know, they say, okay, we'll open another one, you know. But because of the sea lions and then later on, a little bit further down the track, there's a lot of seabirds nest on these islands. The Abrolhos Islands provide a really terrific nesting habitat for ocean wandering seabirds. So there's the what we call the shearwaters. There's a lot of other species of birds nest there. And when the shearwaters come in, they actually dig burrows and nest in burrows on the island. And so they'd seen these burrows and they thought they were lizards or something around them. But eventually they realized that the birds were coming back in at night into these burrows to get the nest ready and to start laying eggs and so on. And so they were able to capture them by the score every night for about 2 or 3 months, these birds coming back in. And so they had a very good supply of fresh seabird there to keep them going as well, you know, through August, September.
So they scraped out a living on this, or they scraped out an existence on Gun Island for a time before they decided finally to send a group out on the longboat to try to reach Batavia, just as Francisco Pelsart did 100 years prior with the Batavia. What was the result of that effort?
Yeah, so they had a, after a month of, after a couple of weeks of being on the island, they got themselves organized and got the longboat set up with sails and built it up a bit, and they picked the dozen of their best sailors to head off to Batavia to seek rescue. The same, pretty much, I guess, like you're saying, like the Batavia had done. And they sent them off one afternoon, and they were never heard of again. How far they got, we don't know. But, you know, they were on the southern group of the islands. There's two more big groups of reefs and islands and so on, you know, within the next 80 kilometres or so. And then you've got all of that rugged coast of Australia with the steep, really, you know, 200 k's of vertical cliffs, what they call the Zitdorp cliffs, and the rest of the countryside's really rugged as well. So whatever happened to them, we have no idea, but they were never, ever heard of again. And of course, those left on the island, you know, waited two months, they should be starting to come back, build a cairn, put a flag up, no sign of anyone coming out. After 3 months, they gave up and said, well, it looks like they didn't make it and nobody's kind of come to our rescue.
That would have been still winter in Australia. So winter storms, I'm guessing, some pretty strong gales in that part of the ocean. I'm sure they probably foundered at some point and capsized, and that was the end, unfortunately for them.
Yeah. You know, low small boat. And I sometimes look at it and think, I wonder if they maybe even, you know, lasted the first day before they got themselves into trouble, because the winds were they had no idea what was ahead of them. There was no charts or anything to go by around the Abrolhos, and just getting out of the Abrolhos would have been really treacherous as well. And of course, when you're in a sailboat, you know, there's little you can do. I don't think they would have been able to anchor to if they saw disaster ahead. They maybe didn't even last the day.
And after they waited a period of time, you know, several months, as you said, they realized that they were never going to get off this island unless they did something to help themselves. So they start building a boat. What did they make this boat out of? Actually, it was a pretty big boat because they had, you know, close to 100 people still on the island. And it had to be seaworthy, of course, to make it all the way to Batavia.
They were able to go backwards and forwards to the Zeewik, which had stayed pretty intact, up to a point out on the reef. And from there, they were able to get all sorts of materials they needed, for their day-to-day survival. And I guess looking at that, they also, they had carpenters on board, and these carpenters were experienced shipbuilders. And they would have been looking at it and saying, eventually, you know what, we've got everything we need here to build our own boat. And they would have put their minds to it and said, well, like you say, we've got 100 people. How big is it going to need to be to carry 100 people, you know, doing all the figuring out, coming up with a basic plan, which evidently sort of was more or less a bit like some of the boats they were, simple little boats they were building back in the Netherlands. And, I think the all credit to the carpenter. I think the carpenter is one of the untold heroes of this whole saga, you know, that he managed to, number one, come up with a plan, marshal everybody around to get the bits and pieces he need, went backwards and forwards to the ship, you know, I need some decking, I need a big spar for this, I need something to make the mast out of, I need all the pulleys, I need all the ropes, I need all the sails, and, you know, getting all that They needed what they called the knees to sort of hold the ribs of the ship. So they went off to an island to the east and found mangrove trees over there that were quite large and were able to, say large 2 or 3 meters stem trunks on them, which they were able to cut and drag back, 15 kilometers across the, in these little boats, bring them back and gradually build the ship and get it all together. And of course, they built it up on the island. And around the island, the water's pretty shallow. They then had to sort of remember that we've got to launch this thing somehow as well. So they eventually, got all the hull and that together, then put it out into the shallow water, built a bit more, and gradually moved it out into deeper and deeper water. So they needed to add more and more weight to it and so on. But, 17-metre boat. And it's the only record I can find of shipwrecked sailors, and I hope someone can maybe disprove this or prove it, one or the other, of shipwrecked sailors actually building a ship of that size out of their wreckage and getting away. So it's a really phenomenal story. And, of course, the other thing is this is the first ship built in Australia. It's sort of just a remarkable story that they built this thing. A friend of mine, Adrian de Jong, who's a Dutch guy, has gone through all of the documents, and there's a little drawing of it on the charts that they made later, showing a little bit like it was like. And he figured out all of the scale of it and how it might sit in the water and what might be required, and little clues from the journals, and put together plans for it, and has built a little model. And it's quite terrific to see that it actually, was quite feasible, to build this thing that eventually, it could take nearly 100 people. Remarkable, absolutely remarkable to do this on this little island out in the middle of the ocean, grabbing stuff from your shipwreck and getting it all together with the, the tools they had at the time. Just remarkable.
It certainly is. And the only thing that comes to mind like it that I can think of is the Wager shipwreck that occurred off the coast of the west coast of Patagonia.
Yeah, the Wager. And what they did there was they actually took a longboat and sorted in half and extended in the middle. So they didn't really build a whole ship. They really just made a longboat a bit longer. So, it, the Wager is a fantastic story. And
it really
is. I had a look at that. And I thought, no, these guys did, but it certainly is nothing compared to the ship that these guys built, which is commonly referred to as the Slopey, but maybe that wasn't what it was they called it. But commonly around, we talk about the Slopey as the being this ship that they built. A bit of the time scale of this is interesting. It began in, June the 9th, and that's, the winter months, June, July, August. By September, it starts, when the winter rains pretty much start to cease. So you've got, 4 or 5, nearly 6 months there during fairly dry summer periods. So it was a long time they were there, right through, and pretty much 9 months, nearly 10 months they were there. So it's a long saga at the edge of the islands, and you just look at it and think about, day by day, what they're up to, and how they managed to build little boats. And like even the island group itself, it's 20 kilometres from one side to the other, and you're surrounded by reefs and shallows and all sorts of things, and yet they got out there in these little boats and went off to these and explored all these other islands and chased birds and sea lions and got timber and water and whatever. Even that would have been a hugely risky undertaking, because the winds are pretty much constantly southwesterly, southerly, strong gales that would have easily swept you away from the islands out into deep water if you weren't very, very careful. Just that they managed to make such a go of it while they were there and managed to survive. Quite a few died along while they were there from various causes. They don't tell us exactly why, but maybe just scurvy, maybe just people from illness. A lot of these guys were pretty crook by the time they were wrecked anyway. So, just the harsher conditions, living in tents out in the open and so on would have been pretty hard. So, it's surprising that they didn't all survive.
And this is just another story that demonstrates why I really want to tell these stories, because there's so much more than just a ship that sunk, that there are real people that had real circumstances and life or death situations and the struggle that they had to face to survive. And that's why I do this. That's why I tell these stories. Exactly what you just said. All of that effort, all of that desperation, and the struggle just to make it to the next day.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. And as you say, once you start thinking out from the individual's point of view, like I was mentioning the guy Fawkes, and you know, sort of what his time on the islands might have been like. There was, you know, how the skipper Staines, you know, how things went for him while he was there. The carpenter as a character. There was another bloke on board called the Comforter of the Sick. Well, you think, well, what was the job of the Comforter of the Sick, and how did he go about his business on the islands, and so on, and you know, what might have been the things that he experienced and so on there, and the, you know, the crew of these little boats, you know, you pick your best sailors and send them off, you know, they would have been all excited, I've been chosen, and then, you know, maybe within a day or two they're dead. You know, it's just a story that just so many angles to investigate, and it's not just the ship ran up on the reef and there was a wreck, you know, that's it.
Just before Halloween in 1985, a pipe bomb exploded in an office building in downtown Salt Lake City, killing a man and leaving the entire city on edge. As the smoke cleared and investigators began the search for answers, it became terrifyingly clear that this was just the beginning. Suddenly, looking for the culprit became a race against time. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, the desperate hunt for a killer leads the authorities through the complicated world of historic document collectors, and eventually, right to the door of the Mormon Church. Listen to American Criminal, The Salt Lake City Bombings, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
So they set off on the 26th of March, and by this time it was 1728. 88 men boarded the, what we're going to call the Sloopy, and set sail for Batavia. Six of them died on the way, but of course that must have been a very difficult journey. It's surprising that more than six didn't die. And they made it. They made it to Batavia, remarkably. Now, the VOC wasn't generally too pleased when any of their ships were lost, and they were known pretty well for harsh punishments. What kind of reception did Captain Staines receive when they arrived in Batavia?
Well, it was, that like you were saying, the voyage in that boat with 88 on board was quite remarkable, you know, because they first of all had to get there, then they had to get around the Sunda Strait. And actually, one of the things interesting, the guy Fawkeson, who'd actually not seen not recognize the waves ahead and caused the wreck of the ship. Actually, the journals say he fell overboard and drowned just before they got up near Java. And you sort of wonder whether maybe he had an idea of the sorts of punishments he might have been about to receive up there, because even though they reinstated everybody in their sailing jobs and he was a mate on board again, I wouldn't be surprised if he said, okay, it's time for me to get out of here, and slipped over the side in the nighttime or something. But, Fawkeson fell over and drowned is what the journals say. But, of course, by the time they got up to the Sunda Straits, things were pretty desperate on board. And it seems that Staines himself was suffering really, really severely from scurvy. A ship in the Straits there that used to just intercept any incoming ships from Europe and just check out who they were and so on for the Dutch. And of course, when that came along, it was a huge surprise, because these guys have been, you know, they're 9 months overdue from their voyage. Everyone presumed they'd just gone missing. Nobody knew what had happened to them. So, you know, they're all elated to find them there. But Staines actually wrote a really weird note in which he accused the crew around him of seizing all of the money, treating him really badly, taking over the ship, almost, you know, turning into pirates and so on, and pleading for help. And this really weird note, which then was sent back off into the Dutch in Batavia. Of course, they immediately thought, once they got this note, that something really adverse was going on, and they sent out a fleet of ships to intercept them with soldiers. And of course, when they got on board, they found everything was okay, except the skipper, Steins, was in a bit of a delirium, evidently suffering from scurvy. And they actually found, you know, all of the chests of silver on board. They'd brought the 10 chests of silver with them. The only thing they found was that all these little packets of money stowed around the ship, which belonged to the crew. And of course, they, you know, this wasn't allowed for them to bring their money out. And the skipper had some money there as well. He actually had 700 ducats or something, which was he was supposed to have spent on food, but he didn't. He'd kept from himself. Even the VOC official on board had a little stash of money. So when you think about it, there should have been great elation that all these people had survived. But in fact, the VOC were more interested in the fact that they had all this contraband money on board that they shouldn't have had, and that became the major focus. But they took it pretty well. Of course, eventually, as far as the crew went, decided that they couldn't prove whether it was their own money or what the story was, so they let them keep it, partly as sort of compensation as what they'd been through. But, of course, the Jan Steins, he was in a lot of trouble because he'd disobeyed orders. He'd actually falsified the records. He'd actually hadn't spent the money that had been given the way he was supposed to. He maybe could have expected to be executed, to be honest, but or suffer some beatings, whatever. But they took all of his possessions off him, didn't pay him, banished him from any places where the VOC were operational, and basically banned him for working for the VOC again. So they totally destroyed him. And initially they said, we're going to parade you around with a sign on your neck saying falsifier, you know, in the marketplace and so on. He eventually got out of that. But after that, we don't hear any more of what happened to him. So he just disappeared into obscurity. And after that as well, we're not even sure if he got back to the Netherlands.
Yeah, he is lucky that he wasn't executed. Like we were saying before, the VOC governor down there in Batavia was... All of the governors were notoriously harsh on any kind of crimes like that, especially when it cost them a lot of money.
Yeah, well, they were very keen to make an example. You know, when they first heard of all of this pirating and so on, they thought the crew was up to. They were very keen to get stuck into and make a big example of them. And they almost sort of feel as though they were a bit disappointed when things turned out to be not quite as bad as Steins had made out in his little note. Yeah, just a remarkable story, this one. You know, it's just that we say that, you know, the Batavia is the big one, but it's this one, I think, is just an equally remarkable story. A different outcome, not the, you know, the murder and mayhem with the other one, but certainly just an absolutely remarkable story in its own right, and deserves to be up there with the Batavia.
Certainly. And, you know, I didn't know much about it before I started reading about it and preparing for this interview. And yeah, it lacks some of the, you know, I guess we could call it intrigue of the bloodlust and some of the bad blood between some of the crew and the captain. However, just that the story of survival, eking out an existence on this basically just a coral reef sticking up out of the water, and then making it all the way to Batavia in the longboat that they built from scratch, that is extremely impressive.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Yeah. It's there are a lot of undertones in the journals are very, very brief in detail about what was going on, but you read in between the lines and you can see that essentially once they'd got ashore on Gun Island, the common hands, as they call them, were ruling the roost, that Steins really had lost his authority. And, you know, so if they wanted stuff, they would basically order it and, you know, it would be delivered. So that Steins really just more or less had to go along with some of that. There was that very unsavory incident where a couple of boys were accused of sodomy and eventually it was decided to punish them. They didn't execute them, but they put them way off in one corner of the little group of islands, put each one on a separate island. You know, these islands are sort of surrounded by coral reefs and deep water, nothing on them, just coral shingle. And they each were put on separate islands, apparently within sight of each other, and left to die. So that was the fate of those two. So there was a couple of incidents like that, a flogging at one stage and things. But generally, the whole tone of it seems to have been that they managed to avoid a lot of what went on with the Batavia, and there seemed to be no indication of anything that they might sort of seize a rescue ship or something like that. They obviously worked very cooperatively when it came to building the Slopey, and I guess they saw there was no other alternative. We've got to build our own ship and get out of here. It's up to us. So, remarkable story of resilience and, initiative and hard work and just getting backwards and forwards to the reef, dragging bits and pieces of the ship across through the shallows, over the reef, pulling this other one to pieces. Just incredibly hard work. And, the guys who did all of that while living on minimal rations and so on, just an astonishing story.
The Zavik wasn't discovered until about 250 years later. How was it found? What led to its discovery?
There was, of course, the chart, that Stones and the Van de Graaff, the second in command, both of those drew charts of the island and the southern group of the Abrolhos, the Pelsart group it's called today, and showed where the wreck site was. So the Morlis knew where it was, but Europeans weren't all that familiar with it, the British when they came. When a couple of English hydrographers, Wickham and Stokes, came in 1840 and charted the islands, they seemed to know of the story, and they found a gun on the island, which was left behind by the Dutch, hence they gave it the name Gun Island. But they found other wreckage and stuff there as well, which they thought it was Batavia wreckage because they knew a bit about that story. But of course, you remember, to begin with, they didn't know about the other two groups of islands either. So that maybe led them to put some names on prematurely. Then, so there's a bit of wreckage around. Then when the late 1800s, a lot of guano mining took place. A company was set up and these guys came in and dug up all the old bird droppings and stuff as guano for fertilizer, shipped it off to Europe. And in digging that up on Gun Island, they found a lot of the material left behind by the Dutch, including they found burial skeletons, they found all the big old water bottles and jars and scissors and metal objects, and everything you can imagine was there on the island left behind. They didn't take anything they didn't need to. And so they recovered all of that, and that was recognised as being from the Zeewick. The actual site of the wreck itself wasn't really discovered until the 1950s, where a fisherman setting his crave pots, his lobster pots, out on the edge of the reef, found some cannon and stuff there. Later on, lots of that was found in the shallows. And then it wasn't probably until the 1960s that another party, Hugh Edwards and others, actually went looking exactly for the site and more or less found a few more cannons and things around. But one of the results of the ongoing studies since then has been that there seems to be too many cannons and anchors for just one ship. There's not enough there really for two ships in terms of wreckage and other stuff, but there's too much for one ship. And Hugh Edwards, one of our local shipwreck hunters, is convinced that there's actually another ship called the Agdekirk, which went missing the year before, wrecked in exactly the same spot. That's his theory. And he's always trying to prove that the Agdekirk is there, to explain this other material. And some of the things that the Zeewick guys said, that they found objects and shipwreck material and stuff around on the islands that they thought it indicated there'd been a shipwreck there before as well. So there's another great mystery there which still isn't solved, and maybe one day it will be.
Is the Zeewick still being excavated today?
It's surprising, there's still occasional bits of timber, there's still lots of cannons there, there's lots of material left on the ocean floor. It's all protected under shipwreck acts and so on, but the main bit of the wreck is still over the edge of the reef, and that really is not well recorded. But certainly the things that have survived are the cannons and some anchors and stuff like that, so they're still around. And of course a lot of material has been excavated from Gun Island, and it makes up some terrific displays that are now in the Shipwrecks Gallery in the Fremantle Museum.
That was going to be my next question, where the artifacts are.
Yeah, so yeah, terrific collection down there, and you know, it just gives you a really good indication of the you know, of what partly what was on these ships and what their life might have been like on the islands. You know, these huge big glass water bottles that they had, and you know, just the, all of the little bits and pieces that were around tell you a lot about the way of life at the time. So it's, you know, really significant little collection.
Have you been out to Gun Island?
Yeah, I've been to Gun Island and, you know, snorkeled around in the shallows and dived off the little bit out on the edge, but not sort of not deep out on the edge, because you never really get a decent day to get out there, and finding the exact spot is really, really hard. The archaeologists really get out there, but certainly Gun Island's reasonably accessible. There's nothing to see there. It's actually, you know, since the guano miners came, they sort of stripped it bare. Back in the 1960s, there was an oil rig set up on it looking for oil, and fortunately I didn't find any, but they sort of leveled the place and changed it a bit again. So poor little old Gun Island has had a pretty rough time of it. Yeah, the sea lions are still back. They've come back in a few, not nearly the numbers they used to be, but there's still usually half a dozen or a dozen sea lions hanging around the edge, which, you know, of course they were, you know, would have been food for the Zeewik guys.
Well, Dr. Gray, you are an author, historian, eco-tour guide, expert of all things regarding the Batavia Coast and the Haltman Obrolhos. Where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
You know, I do have a little Facebook page. People are welcome to follow that. I've got a lot of stories together. I do, in fact, have a little novel of, around the Batavia called Lucretia's Batavia Diary, which does, everyone enjoys that. A little good little book on the spice trade called Spice at Any Price by Frederick de Houtman. That's a great little story. And they're available through my webpage, which is called Westralian Books, Westralian Books. You can find them there and ship them anywhere around the place. I've got a little novel in the works called The Zeewik Stowaway. So a little story around the supposed story of a stowaway on board. So he can tell the story. I'm in the middle of that. That's good fun. And actually, and also in the middle of a little book on the, reasonable book on the natural and human history of the Haltman Obrolhos Islands called Keep Your Eyes Open, which of course is what Obrolhos essentially means. So, but they'll be out this year and early next year, I think. So keep an eye out for those. But Westralian Books is a good place to start. Otherwise, do a bit of Googling. Apparently, I'll pop up here and there all over the place. Thanks very much, Rich. It's really good to talk with you. I really enjoy the work you're doing. Fantastic.
Oh, it's my pleasure to have you on again. I genuinely love talking to you and hearing your stories and filling in all of this information about the really colorful history of the waters of Western Australia. It's fantastic.
Thanks, Rich.
That is going to do it for the story of the Zeewik. Thank you so much to Dr. Howard Gray for once again sharing his wealth of knowledge with us. You can find his books, including Lucretia's Batavia Diary, at westralianbooks.com.au. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is written, edited, and produced by me, Rich Napolitano. You can follow the show on social media, at ShipwrecksPod, or at shipwrecksandseadogs.com. You can support the show by making a single donation at buymeacoffee.com/shipwreckspod, or you can subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com/shipwreckspod. You'll get ad-free listening to this and many other history podcasts, as well as bonus content and a private Discord channel. Original theme music is by Sean Siegfried, and you can follow him at seansiegfried.com or on YouTube at SeanSecret. Please join me again next time, but until then, don't forget to wear your life jackets.